From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, state legislators narrowly pass a rescue package for Detroit public schools. We'll hear from some of those lawmakers.
We have given them a great start, but the rest of the hard work is going to be on the school board, on the community itself.
For the first time in my legislative career, I've got to tell you, I'm ashamed to be a legislator today.
Plus, Michigan, Michigan State, and Wayne State working together in Detroit, and it's paying off.
Some of their computer science and engineering grads who historically were going to Silicon Valley and Seattle are now thinking twice about that because you've got Google here, you've got Amazon here.
And how do you help a preschooler succeed in school when his or her parents are immigrants who may not speak English? You coach parent and child. Those stories and much more today for you on Stateside. But first, the news. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Governor Snyder is poised to sign a $617 million Detroit Public School aid package, which narrowly passed the state Senate late last night. The plan would pay off the district's debts and set up a new district, and it returns control of the district to a locally elected school board following seven straight years of state emergency management. It passed without support of Democrats or Detroit lawmakers. Let's get reactions now from some state lawmakers as we begin with Ottawa County Republican Representative Amanda Price. She's chair of the House Education Committee. Welcome, Representative. Good to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
What do you think of the legislation that passed the Senate last night?
Well, I think it's a great day for kids in Detroit because they will have a better future because this legislation has passed both the House and the Senate.
Why?
Less of the money going to the debt in Detroit and more into the classroom.
What did the package not have that you thought should have been in there?
I think the package was very complete and, you know, if... This is one of the most difficult challenges I've faced and a number of my colleagues have faced since we've been in the legislature because with the city bankruptcy, for instance, it was a matter of paying debt down and the city infrastructure would return to normal. This case is more difficult. There's debt and academic performance that needed to be addressed. And so, you know, we didn't have a method to follow because no other district in the country had been through something like this. And I think what is in the package will help the school district and the students in Detroit succeed.
One of the questions that I've got about this package is it calls for a way that would allow uncertified teachers to teach in Detroit. Why do you think this is good education policy?
Well, we already have a policy like that in place in law now. It allows for high school teachers to do that, and it allows for it under the legislation for Detroit, but doesn't mandate it. So it's another alternative way for teachers to enter the classroom, and I think it opens up pathways for a lot of folks who have a lot of expertise in areas and want to share them, and that's already available in the high school setting, but people who really are passionate about education and would like to have that opportunity in a city like Detroit.
Now, there are critics who are arguing that this is basically retaliation against the teachers in the union. Was there some degree of punishment involved in this?
We voted for the kids in Detroit. We didn't do this to punish teachers. We didn't do it to punish anybody. We voted so that the kids in Detroit can have a brighter future.
The Detroit Public Schools have been under state control for 14 of the last 17 years. What's your sense of the state's role in the situation that DPS finds itself in today?
I think, initially the district came under management from the state because of poor finances, and ultimately there has been equal blame, maybe not equal blame, but blame on all sides for the way the district is currently. And so I don't want to look at the past. I want to look at the future. And, you know, Cynthia, we can talk about the money or the unions or the teachers. The hard part of all of this is not what's happened in the last few days in the legislature. The hard part is going to start today and next week when people take back control of the school district and reform academics in the city of Detroit.
What will that take to be successful, in your view?
A lot of hard work. And it's not just teachers, and it's not just administrators. It's parents engaging. It's the whole community getting involved in turning around the academic performance in Detroit.
And yet Detroit lawmakers from both the House and Senate say they had very, very little input into this final package. What do you think that says to these parents and to the parents of the children that we're talking about?
I think they actually did have a lot of input. I've heard and listened to a lot of conversations, lots of dinners, lots of conversations with teachers, administrators, tours of schools in Detroit. So there has been a lot of input. Moving forward and getting the legislation passed didn't have their votes, but there has been a lot of input.
What do you think that any of the Detroit lawmakers got in this package that they wanted to see?
I think they have a district that walks away from an operating deficit of $500 million and a new start, a restart for the school district.
Are you confident that what's been passed will ensure that the Detroit Public Schools financial situation isn't back in front of you again in another 5 or 10 years?
I am not confident of that because the work that we've done to alleviate the operating deficit is only one aspect of the whole financial well-being of the Detroit Public Schools. It's going to take a lot of hard work, and we have given them a great start, but the rest of the hard work is going to be on the school board, on the community itself.
If the package fails to set DPS on a sound fiscal path, in your view, who would be to blame?
I think, again, school districts have the responsibility to responsibly manage their finances.
But knowing that Detroit has not had that power for 14 of the last 17 years, I guess what role, who else do you think would be a part of that? Detroit has not been able to do that.
They've had their operating, with this package of legislation, their operating deficit goes away, and they have now to manage the rest of their finances.
Republican Representative Amanda Price, who's chair of the House Education Committee. Appreciate your time today, Representative. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
West Michigan Republican Senator Jeff Hansen spent over a year trying to craft a bipartisan aid package, which ended up being upended by the House of Representatives. And it was that Republican plan which cleared the Senate. Senator Jeff Hansen is with us now. Senator, what do you want to say about the package that passed last night?
Well, I think that the package that passed is a start. I think that, first of all, the people in Detroit will take what has been given to them, and they will make it work because they're resilient. They're great people. I spent a lot of time down there, and the folks really want to have a better education system for their kids. So I see that this is a step. Just had a little disappointment with some of the things that were in there.
Yeah, let's get into that. What were you most disappointed about?
Well, some of the punitive part concerned me a little bit. I really felt that when I started this procedure, you know, trying to get this package together, it was going to be all about trying to fix the emergency problem. The other policy issues that people wanted to deal with, you know, we could deal with that separately and have the discussion and not to have things put into this bill to have that, because there's no real policy discussion on those.
You worked, as you say, 15 months. You went back and forth to Detroit. You worked so hard to craft that bipartisan plan, including that Detroit Education Commission that was opposed by the charter school lobby. Is it wrong to say, despite all of that, the House pretty much got its way last night?
It's a challenge because it was the House version. They took the bill that I had put together and the framework that we had put together and crafted their own legislation and sent it over. So it wasn't exactly what I put together.
And my understanding is that as you spoke last night, you came to tears.
Well, it's an emotional thing because, you know, we have worked hard. My chief of staff, Peter Wills, and I have been, you know, we've been living this for over a year. And so it is very emotional because you get to the end and it's not exactly as you envision it. And it gets a little bit disappointing. You know, that being said, I'm glad that we were able to get some funding to get some of the reforms and get some of the things started.
Now, we were a little unclear. We were trying to piece things together. Exactly how did you vote last night, Senator Hansen?
I voted against the main bill in the package because of some of the things that were in there. I had asked to be able to try and fix some of the issues, was not allowed, so I wasn't able to support it.
Now, what works in your mind as far as what was passed? And I'm particularly interested in whether you think the dollars and cents add up. Is it enough?
Well, it's going to have to be enough for now. I think if there's some things that are done, there's some other things that can be done to help free up some money that I think they're going to be looking at some other options. Hopefully it's enough, and they're going to be able to hit the ground running. And I mean, it's a clean start. It's pushing the reset button and starting all over. As long as everybody gets involved and is part of the solution, it'll work.
Senator, after that House package passed, I dug up a story that Senator Arlen Meekhoff, the majority leader, and here's his quote. He said, "I want the thought leaders and opinion leaders to buy into the solution. I want them to want it to work. That's very, very important to our caucus." Hearing that now, in retrospect, why didn't that happen? Why were Detroit lawmakers unable to have any fingerprints in this?
Well, that was part of the frustration with me is, you know, I worked very hard to make sure that we did have a bipartisan package. I worked with my Democratic colleagues for probably 6 months before we even put a bill in, you know, meeting and talking about what's in the bill, making sure that at the end of the day it's something that would work for the folks from Detroit. It was disheartening that we didn't end up with a bipartisan solution, as we could have, because it just ended up going, you know, politics gets in the way and it becomes partisan.
And you call this package a start. Is there a feeling in your mind that you could be back in the middle of another rescue plan for Detroit Public Schools in perhaps the not too distant future?
I don't think it's a rescue plan. I think it's more of a, and the plan wasn't just to do this and walk away from the beginning. There are other things. We have to continue to work with the folks in Detroit to see what they need, to see if we can help, to make sure that they do have an opportunity to be successful.
Senator Jeff Hansen, Republican Senator from Hart. Thank you so much for talking with us today, Senator Hansen.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Coming up, helping immigrant families succeed. One group's helping both parent and child. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This coming Sunday, June 12th, is Loving Day. It marks the 49th anniversary of the U.S. Supreme Court decision in the case of Loving versus Virginia. This landmark decision struck down the criminality of interracial marriage in America. They'll be celebrating Loving Day this Sunday in Grand Rapids with a full day of film, music, and theater put on for one and all by the Ebony Road Players. It's a Grand Rapids theater company. Edie Evans-Hyde is executive director of the Ebony Road Players. She joins us via Skype. Edie, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Edie, take us back to June 12, 1967. What was the case of Loving versus Virginia about?
Basically, it was about two people from Virginia, Richard and Mildred Loving, who got married in Washington, D.C., but they lived in Virginia at the time. And in Virginia, I don't know if they did not know this or not, but it was illegal for them to be married.
And why was that?
They were an interracial couple.
So Mildred was African American and Native American?
Yes.
And Richard was a white man?
Yes.
What happened then? They got married and then they moved to Virginia.
Well, and they actually lived in Virginia, but they went to Washington to get married. And when they came back, I guess it gotten out that they had gotten married, even though they had been friends and lived in the same area. Everyone knew them pretty much as a couple, but legally during that time, they weren't supposed to be married. So when they got back home, they were immediately arrested and was threatened with a year of imprisonment if they did not leave Virginia.
And what happened then?
They left Virginia, but kept sneaking back in. Richard kept sneaking. They needed to be separated is what the deal was. Mm. And eventually, and I think it was during the time with Robert Kennedy and the civil rights movement, Mildred got very brave and decided to write Mr. Kennedy and just say, we want to be married. We want to stay together. And this couple, this Southern couple who you would never think they would do something as bold as this, took this all the way to the Supreme Court. And it's an amazing story of what two non-assuming, just regular citizens can do to change a country.
And now we have Loving Day, an annual celebration each June 12th. What's the goal of what you have planned for West Michigan Loving Day celebration?
Well, the Loving Day celebration, I actually went to my first one in Los Angeles, and it was just an amazing artistic event. And because we are a theater company, we want to try to get stories out of people who normally don't get a chance to tell their story, underrepresented voices. And the Loving Story is an attempt for us to tell this story, tell the history and how it is very important for us to know even today, to celebrate the multicultural families in our community and encourage inclusion and diversity, and to just say, hey, it's okay. We can do this together and enjoy some great art together while telling this story.
So give us some details. This is really not just a drop-in for an hour. You've got a full day planned.
Yes, from 12 o'clock noon until 8 o'clock. During the first part of it, we will have a community event. Basically, it's like a block party in the Wealthy Street District. If anyone's from Grand Rapids, you know where Wealthy Street is. So we're having face painting and music and just fun food and different things going on for families. Later on in the afternoon, we will have a film series produced by the Mosaic Film Experience. They will be showing some student films that are about diversity and inclusion and self-awareness.
And this is interesting, being high school students exploring these themes, so you'll get a chance to get their perspective.
Yes, and these are wonderful films that will be going on during that time. We have an original play that's going on by Randy Wyatt called One Simple Question. Basically, the play is built around story circles of people that we interviewed, and the stories were built around that. And then we're having a concert at the end. In the middle of it, though, I should say, we are showing the HBO film, The Loving Story, and having a panel discussion about that movie and about the importance of it in our country.
Full day with a lot of different artistic expressions of a very important point. And I want to get your thought on this important point. What do you believe the Loving decision has meant to this country in the nearly five decades since it was handed down?
Well, I think that now, going through the last marriage decision that we had last year, this court case was actually used in that Supreme Court case for the gay marriage issue. And it's amazing to me how those same issues and those same questions and why we should respect people's ability to love each other is something that's going on right now again. And the fact that they used that court case of 1967 for this court case of last year was amazing to me. I also think that a lot of people take that court case for granted. I tell people, well, 1967, and they look at me like, that wasn't really that long ago. And it really wasn't that long ago. To keep that in the forefront, that we as Americans tend to go through this quite often, but we don't have a very long history with giving people equality like this.
It is a nice bit of, I don't want to say irony, but a nice coincidence that the couple's last name was Loving, so you can talk about,
yes,
Loving Day.
Yes. Isn't that amazing? I just love it that that's their name.
Edie Evans-Hyde is executive director of the Ebony Road Players, and you can find out more about West Michigan's Loving Day celebration coming up this Sunday by going to their website, ebonyroad.org. Hope the weather will be as equally sunny as the message that will be sent out this coming Sunday. Thank you so much, Edie.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Collaborative.
Experimentation.
The next idea.
We need a participation revolution, and we need it fast.
How do you help a preschooler succeed in school when his or her parents are immigrants? They may not even speak English. The answer You help the kids succeed by coaching the parents, by guiding parent and child. An innovative program in Dearborn and Detroit is doing exactly that with great success. The Arab Community Center for Economic and Social Services, ACCESS, put together a team of educators and social workers, and they developed a way to get recent immigrant families ready for school, parents and preschoolers. They call the program Parent and Child Interactive Learning, PICL for short. Amanda Morgan helped to develop this program, and she's now on the faculty of the School of Social Work at Michigan State University. Welcome, Amanda.
Hello.
Good to have you with us. And Thoraya Al-Hagam is one of the parents who has been part of the PICL program. She immigrated from Yemen to Michigan 7 years ago. Thank you so much for joining us today, Thoraya.
Thank you.
Amanda, what was the problem that you were trying to solve in developing this program?
In Detroit, we noticed that there were high rates of illiteracy among adults, and the children that were entering kindergarten all over Detroit were not ready for school. They were not ready to perform academically. They were not ready socially and emotionally. And this was particularly challenging for high immigrant population communities. There were many school readiness programs out there and approaches and some two-generation programs out there, but what ACCESS aimed to do was to look at the unique challenges that faced immigrant communities and build a program from the ground up that was two-generation, that incorporated the parents' learning with the children and teaching the parents how to become their child's first teacher in the home, empowering the parents to learn themselves and teach their children how to get ready for school.
This closes a big, big gap, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really helps the parents build their skills so that they can go on with their education, they can get jobs, they can, you know, provide for their families and build stable environments for their kids to continue learning, not just to get ready for school that initial year, but to really continue on with their academic success. We know that one of the largest predictors of a child's academic success is the reading level of their mother. So when we are working with these parents, ACCESS has been providing English as a second language classes for parents in the community for over 20 years. And we're seeing that, you know, when you empower these parents, you're creating this environment and this family for these kids. So when you teach them how to be the teachers for their children and you give them these strategies and then you coach them and mentor them to get their children ready for school, you're not just working with their kid in this bubble. You're really giving the parents the skills and abilities to do that for this child and any future children to come.
How did you construct the program? What does it look like? And how do you get to the families?
Kind of the traditional approach for a school readiness program is to bring the kids into a preschool setting and work with them. Some of the newer school readiness programs is to incorporate this two-generation approach of bringing in the parents. But even those two-generation approaches that we looked at, those mainstream approaches, were just too fast-paced. The vocabulary is too difficult for a population who doesn't have high English language skills. There's just not enough time. There's not enough mentoring and coaching. Those were really things that we took a look at. We made sure that the program had three key elements. One, teaching the parents the content. So making sure that the parents did know the English alphabet. They did know the shapes and the colors themselves. They knew how to pronounce them correctly and draw them and identify them. They knew what the words trace and match meant and how to use them correctly, and allowing them time to practice that content and those strategies, mentoring and coaching the parents. So the parents learn that content separately from their children. They're given that time. And then we bring the parents and children together and we give them interactive activities with that content to do together. During that time that they're practicing those strategies, we have teachers in the classroom that are coaching and mentoring those parents the entire time, building awareness with those parents around what does it mean to be ready for school? What does it mean when we say children should start learning from birth? How do children develop? How do their brains develop? How do they develop physically? What are some things they should be doing? So all three of those key elements were built into the program from the very beginning.
Is it over a long period of time?
It's pretty concentrated. It's a 10-week course. you know, we can't fit everything in. You have from 0 to 5 to get your kid ready for school, really. We know that it's not realistic that parents are going to bring their kid to our program for 5 years, but in that 10-week session, our focus is really teaching parents how to do these things at home. We're teaching them the strategies and empowering them to be able to do these things, but really to take those things and do them at home and not teaching them with these expensive materials and things that they're not going to have access to, really teaching them with things that they can do in their home. So teaching them how to teach a rectangle by pointing out a cereal box, or that the door looks like a rectangle, and so that when they leave, they're able to continue this after they leave the program.
Let me turn now to Thoraya Al-Hagam. As you were in this program, Thoraya, what did you like about it?
I like it a lot because it gives me confidence, helped me teach my kids, to teach them how to be ready for school.
What kinds of things would you do in the classes with them?
We do a lot of things like reading, coloring, matching and stuff, shapes sometimes, a lot of things.
And are you doing things with your children now that you weren't doing before Pickle?
Yeah, we're doing a lot like rhyming inside the house, getting the same word have same ending. Sometimes counting the stairs, counting the doors inside the house. A lot of fun things and we're doing that right now. It's more fun to us to learn, fun to me and fun my kids to be with together, learning more and more for school.
Thoraya, how old are your children?
I have 6 and 5 now. He turned 5 like months ago.
And they're in class now. How are they doing in school? What level are they at and how are they doing?
The first one, kindergarten. The other one, pre-kindergarten. Both of them same lover, but they're doing great. The kindergarten one start reading. The under one, he start holding pen, writing letters, draw. Before he doesn't like even hold the pen. Now he's doing better.
And how about you, Thoraya? How did this process and this program, how did it change you?
It gave me the confidence. It helped me to understand children better, helped me to have the confidence to teach my kids. And if I don't know how to help them, I have the resource to ask, to know how to do with them if I have a problem or something I couldn't do with them.
Amanda Morgan, over the years, the 4 years that this program's been going on at Access, have you seen this program impact ways that recent immigrants begin to feel more at ease, maybe a greater sense of belonging to their new home in Michigan?
Yeah, we have the program located in a Detroit public school, and it's located right in their neighborhood. We try to encourage the parents to be involved with the school, to go to parent meetings at the school, to be involved with the teachers and the administrators. We send staff to parent-teacher conferences to translate for the parents. We go over differences between American school systems and school systems in their home country, and we've just seen a huge, significant difference with their comfort level, between interacting with the schools. It's very different. Everything is very different from where they come from. And so just the comfort level of them with the school systems, and the parents are in English as a second language classes as a part of this program, and their comfort level going into the community, going to banks and to grocery stores and feeling empowered to get their driver's license and become U.S. citizens, and just the empowerment that they get from this program and the confidence that they receive just all around, but especially as a part of helping their children and being involved in their education is significant.
Is this a program that you think could be translatable to really any immigrant in any community in our state?
Yes, and I think not just our state, but country. Primarily, our population that we worked with were Arabic and Latino Spanish-speaking students, but we were very intentional from the beginning that we wanted the program to be applicable to all immigrants. We made sure that we built it in a way that it could be used for a diverse group of people. We made sure that the structure, that the time built in to learn and practice, that the content, the way that it was taught for English language learners, everything was done very intentionally so that it could be replicated with a variety of other immigrant populations. And that's what, moving forward, that's what we hope to do. We just published a book on the program, and we hope that we're able to take that book and replicate it in other communities across the country.
And that new book is called Access to School. So tell us, how can people learn more about the program or perhaps get that book?
It's available on Amazon or Barnes & Noble, and they can also visit our website, accesscommunity.org, to learn more.
Amanda Morgan helped to develop the PICL program, Parent and Child Interactive Learning Program with Access in Dearborn. And Thuraya Al-Hagam is a mother of two. She took part in the program with her two children after emigrating from Yemen to Michigan. We want to thank both of you for being with us today on The Next Idea. It was great to have you.
Thank you so much.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Still to come, more reaction to last night's legislative session that ended in a $617 million package for Detroit public schools.
The legislature last night sent a very clear message that they don't care about accountability, they're not fiscally responsible, and they don't care about doing right by the children of Detroit.
In 15 minutes, we talk with Democratic Senator David Kinesic of Detroit. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. The biking community of Kalamazoo turned out last evening for a 5-mile silent ride honoring the cyclist hit by an alleged drunk driver. 5 people were killed and 4 were injured. Paul Selden is the director of road safety for the Kalamazoo Bicycle Club, and he's with Bike Friendly Kalamazoo. Paul, you are part of what seems to be a very large community of bicycle riders in Kalamazoo. Tell us about last night's silent ride.
Last night's outpouring of so many emotions was such a statement, a powerful statement, a silent statement in support of the families and the riders and friends who were touched by the senseless tragedy that occurred the evening of June 7th. I have heard estimates of up to 750 riders coming out of that parking lot at Arcadia Brewing Company last night, and it made me feel so much better than I had been feeling about the senseless tragedy that took place. So in that sense, the ride was part of what I think will be a gradual, it's been called a healing process, and that's not a bad way to put it.
But there's a long way to go.
There's many steps, and it'll be longer for some than others, but I'll tell you, this is a great community. Kalamazoo as a whole is just filled with people who have so much positive energy and are so creative. Even now, we are working on a number of things to try to, as Dory Belts of the River Church put it to me last night, to bring light into darkness. And that is exactly what we are trying to do. And I think it can be done. There are going to be other celebrations of life, put it that way. The lives of those who were lost, lives of those who were injured, celebrating the lives of the rest of us in the community who want to turn something so horrible into something positive.
And certainly this is something that not just the rest of Michigan, but the country, even the world, has known of this story. And now that I've got you as the director of road safety for the Kalamazoo Bicycle Club, I'd love your thoughts, if you could, about something. I was a very robust conversation I noticed today on Facebook, where someone who is a member of the bicycling community basically said, have we hit a stage where we got to admit bicycles and motor vehicles simply shouldn't share lanes? I mean, how can road bikers ever feel safe with texting and drinking added to the driving mix? What is your thought on that? Can cars and bikes safely coexist on the same stretch of road?
They do, and they do every day, and they do with each other, too, and they coexist very well. This is interesting because it's a conversation I had with a friend of mine, Pastor Dale Kruger, just this morning. He asked me more or less the same question. Mm-hmm. He's an ardent bicyclist, and he wondered, is it safe to ride on the roads? Well, it's never completely safe. Come on, we're all adults. We can realize there are dangers out here. But I'll tell you, Cynthia, I ride these roads almost every day. And there are thousands of drivers who pass me, many with wide margins, to show respect and courtesy when I'm on the road. And everything goes fine. In reality, we have to realize this is an anomaly, unfortunately, of tremendous tragic proportions. But it is just that, an anomaly. And if it weren't, we couldn't even cross the road. We'd be afraid to, you know, the proverbial, we'd be afraid to get out of bed in the morning. So in my mind, the roads are just as safe or dangerous, if you want to put it that way, because riding a bicycle or driving a car is not risk-free. But we're just as safe today as we were yesterday. We have to be vigilant. We have to know how to ride on the road if we're using the roads. We have to even know how to ride on a trail, a multi-use path, if we're trying to coexist with pedestrians and skateboarders when we're riding. That is always a requirement. We can't underestimate that. We should wear helmets. We should have well-equipped bikes with mirrors, you know, reflectors, all of that kind of thing. But having said that, met those requirements, I feel just as safe today as I did on June 7th before this tragic incident occurred. So that may sound like I'm ignoring the facts, but I don't think so. I think those are the facts. The drivers in our state, in our county, in our towns, by and large, are very safe, or we wouldn't even want to drive our cars on the road for fear of getting into an accident every day.
Well, Paul Selden is the director of road safety for the Kalamazoo Bicycle Club and also part of Bike Friendly Kalamazoo. You have a right to have that say. And we want to thank you for sharing your thoughts. And as you say, the conversation has begun. And if anything can come out of what happened on Tuesday night that makes everyone more aware of the need for safety, then, as you so well said, light can come out of the darkness.
Thank you, Cynthia, for giving me the chance and to give us some hope for tomorrow.
Time now for our Thursday check-in with Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. This week's focus, University of Michigan, Michigan State University, and Wayne State University, putting traditional rivalries aside and pouring some brain power and expertise into Southeast Michigan and Detroit. Remind everyone again, what is the University Research Corridor?
It's a consortium of Michigan, Michigan State, and Wayne State. It was formed about 10 years ago to essentially pool their expertise on research and applications to business within Southeast Michigan. And they have done, over the years, they've done reports on the blue economy and automotive innovation and information and communication technology, advanced manufacturing, which is, of course, near and dear to our hearts, life sciences, which is very big, of course, in Ann Arbor. And this year, they've done a look at what they're doing in Detroit. They call it Engaging Detroit, and how they're supporting Detroit, spending money in Detroit, doing research in Detroit. It's a very positive story.
And so give us an idea of some of the payoffs for Detroit from the University Research Corridor in dollars and cents. Let's start there.
Well, yeah, they say last year alone, they did about $958 million worth of economic activity in the city of Detroit. Research that totaled about $263 million. This is just in 1 year alone. They have more than 340 programs and initiatives that one of the schools were doing there. Up to 28,000 URC students, they call them URC students, being educated in the city. Of course, a big chunk of those are going to be at Wayne State, obviously. But Michigan and Michigan State have got centers there on Woodward Avenue and are raising their profile. And, you know, 10 years ago, we wouldn't have seen anything like this.
This is really about putting Detroit in a place to manufacture for the future and to not be pulled back by maybe, if we want to say, the weight of the past.
Well, I think that's right. You know, we're moving into a knowledge economy, and this we're in a knowledge economy, frankly. And this town has been formed as a manufacturing blue-collar town that made things. Well, we're still making things, and we're still going to probably continue to make things, but how you do that and the brain power you harness is going to be very different than it was in the past. Accordingly, I think it's really, really important that the CEOs or the presidents of these universities have a seat at the table. And Business Leaders for Michigan, which is kind of the leading CEO roundtable in Michigan, about 8 or 10 years ago, asked them to be full-fledged members of their board. And the presidents at the time sat on those boards. The current presidents of all three universities sit on that board. And that's really important for them to hear from business people about what real practical challenges are facing businesses, the need for talent, the need for certain kinds of educated talent. And it's also important for the CEOs to hear from the presidents. Issues, for example, about funding. Michigan's funding for higher education has been steadily declining. Obviously, in a situation like that, they can at least make that known and sometimes do. And it's probably no accident that Business Leaders for Michigan has been very open about a need for increasing higher education funding.
To the point that you did make about the fact that, yes, Detroit knows how to build things. In your column today, you quote University of Michigan President Mark Schlissel saying, hey, that gives Michigan an advantage over Silicon Valley. We know how to build things.
Well, you know, I'm sure people in Silicon Valley would say, well, yeah, we build things too. We just do it in a different way. But he's right. I mean, fundamentally, I think that's one of the real key things. And I think one of the things that they're learning in Silicon Valley is that a lot of stuff that Detroit does, and I mean Detroit in quotes, not just the city and not just the industry here, but the auto industry more broadly defined, it is difficult. And it's a lot more difficult than maybe outsiders thought when these companies were going down the tubes or felt like it in 2009 and 2010. And now 6 years later, they've learned that it's pretty difficult. And I think as these companies continue to play in each other's sandbox, there's a new kind of appreciation for how difficult things are. General Motors President Dan Ammann said to me in an interview recently, he said, one of the things that we're learning is that what everybody else is doing is really hard.
Let's look at these big three public universities. What are Wayne, Michigan, and MSU getting from all of this activity in that you're spelling out in Detroit?
Well, one thing, they're public universities. They have an obligation. They're funded by public dollars. They have an obligation to the public. And there's no question that Detroit has been a very big, and its revival has been a very big story and the focus of an awful lot of public attention. Secondly, I think they're getting students. I mean, one of the things that surprised me in talking to all three presidents earlier in the week was they have semesters in Detroit, particularly Michigan and Michigan State, and they're oversubscribed. They've got more demand. More kids want to do a semester in Detroit, which is kind of the domestic equivalent of a semester in London or Paris, than they can accommodate. Mm-hmm. And they're leaning on Roy Wilson at Wayne State to ask them for housing and other kinds of assistance because they've got so many people that want to work there or study there and also want to work there. One of the other things that I thought was interesting is that Michigan is starting to see that some of their computer science and engineering grads who historically were going to Silicon Valley and Seattle are now thinking twice about that because you've got Google here, you've got Amazon here, you've got other tech players who are here because they want to get a piece of the automotive action. And as a result, some of these kids are saying, you know what, maybe I can take my first job here and then decide what I'm going to do next.
So we could see perhaps a slowdown in that brain drain we've talked about.
Exactly right.
Detroit News Business columnist Daniel Howes. As always, great talking with you, Daniel. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We've been getting reaction from state lawmakers to last night's narrow passage of that $617 million aid package for Detroit public schools. We heard from Republican Representative Amanda Price, chair of the House Education Committee, and from Republican Senator Jeff Hansen of West Michigan. Now we turn to Democratic Senator David Kinesic of District 5, which include parts of Detroit. What do you want to say about this package, Senator?
I think that first and foremost, I have never been more ashamed of being a legislator here in the state of Michigan. The package that we passed last night sets up Detroit Public Schools for failure. It sets up the children for failure. I guarantee you we are going to be back in the same situation that we're in today, just a few months or a few years down the road. We had an incredible opportunity yesterday to set the children of my community, the children of Detroit, on a path to success, and we abdicated that responsibility. And so, again, I'm just, for the first time in my legislative career, I've got to tell you, I'm ashamed to be a legislator today.
Why do you see this as setting these kids up for failure?
Let's look at the money question, okay? This is a governor. This is an administration who tells us that they care about data. They want data-driven decisions. They want, you know, business-based decisions. Our own Department of Treasury is telling us that the amount of money that was appropriated in these bills is not enough, and that just a few years down the road, the other children in this state, children outside the city of Detroit, they're going to be on the hook for up to $88 million. So why would we ever appropriate a sum of money if it is not the total sum of money that we need to get this problem done correctly? We're kicking the can down the road, and we are setting the district up for failure. And secondly, we've talked a lot about bringing some rhyme and reason to the opening and closing of schools in Detroit. There is nothing in this plan that levels that playing field, that says, if you're a good school, we want you to keep doing good things. We want you to continue to replicate across the city. But if you're a bad school, a C school, a D school, an F school, well, you need to pump the brakes before you go into some other community and start destroying education in someone's backyard. None of that is in this bill. And then you could talk for hours about, you know, some of the blatantly anti-teacher and unproven models that are in here, talking about merit pay, uncertified teachers. What legislator would want uncertified teachers in their children's classrooms? I guarantee you the answer is no. And so it begs the question, when does this stop? But the legislature last night sent a very clear message that they don't care about accountability, they're not fiscally responsible, and they don't care about doing right by the children of Detroit.
Did you and other Detroit Democrats get any chance to be any part of this process?
In the very beginning of this process, I'll tell you, Ms. Canty, we were incredibly involved in the process, and that is why we were able to pass a bipartisan plan for Detroit that came out of the Senate back in March.
And that was working with your colleague, Senator Jeff Hansen.
Absolutely. Jeff Hansen, take a second and consider this. This is a guy from West Michigan who sacrifices his personal relationships, his professional relationships, everything he put on the line to come to my community, to get to know my kids, to get to the solutions that we all want for the children of Detroit. Working with Senator Hansen was great. The product that the House of Representatives sent back to us took that great bipartisan work, that great work that we did over 15 months, and destroyed it in a period of 15 hours. And by the time that product came back to the Senate, there was not a single conversation that included any Detroit Democrats, included anybody who represented the city before that went up for a vote. And so you've got a plan that's supposed to fix the problem in Detroit that doesn't have any support from the Detroiters who is going to affect. And that should be incredibly telling for us as citizens about the type of legislating that took place in the Senate and in the House this last week.
Yeah, I wanted to get into that. What does it say, in your view, to the people of Detroit when their elected representatives have been cut out of developing the package aimed at their children in their schools?
It's incredibly disheartening. I think it makes the case for why we need to end the one-party rule that we currently have in the state today. We need to have the citizens of Detroit to have a seat at the table. As their elected officials, we are entrusted with that responsibility. When we are systematically cut out of the conversations, when we are denied our opportunity to advocate on behalf of our citizens, we get the type of products that we got last night, one that doesn't include any of our input, one that doesn't do anything to improve the quality of life for the students. I guarantee you, Ms. Canty, at some point in every one of our careers, we have said on the campaign trail, it's about the kids, it's about the kids, it's about the kids. The plan that we kicked out yesterday, it's not about the kids. It sets them up for failure. It was about the DeVosses. It was about kowtowing to the whims of a major political donor, about trying to kick the can down the road for a political party who doesn't want to deal with a tough issue in an election year. It's disgusting. We are entrusted with the responsibility of doing better.
And if this legislation doesn't work, if you're back dealing with the same issues and within the next 5 years, who's to blame in your view?
Absolutely, the majority party. And I'm one of these guys, Ms. Canty, I'll tell you, I always look for the bipartisan solution. That's why I wanted to sit at the table. I never want to cast these sort of rocks at folks on the other side of the aisle. I want to work with them to get a better product that does right by the children of Detroit. But I've got to tell you, I have to call it like it is. This was a Republican-only plan for the citizens of Detroit. It sets up a different model, a different system of education, an unequal system of education for the children of Detroit. They have to bear that responsibility. It lies with them and no one else.
Democratic Senator David Kinesic of District 5. Senator, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
We reached out to both legislative leaders, Senate Majority Leader Arlen Meekhoff, House Speaker Kevin Cotter. Their spokespeople said they were unable to break from session today to join us. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.